Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A goal-filled morning of World Cup action means we need to get right into it with the Gegenpod. Former Socceroos Scott McDonald, former Premier League star Michael Bridges and Socceroos icon Mark Schwartz are on the ground in Qatar to talk about it all. We'll debate the Australian connection to one of the most contentious refereeing decisions of the tournament and talk about the breakout star who might be about to command a mammoth transfer fee. I'm your host, Teo Pelizzeri. This is the Optus Sport Football Podcast. Let's get in to the Gegenpod. Yes, it was another action-packed day at the World Cup. So many goals to talk about as well, which is a welcome upturn. And the man who said it was coming after match day one was Michael Bridges. Bridgie, great to have you back on the Gegenpod.
Great to be here, and what a four matches we witnessed today. I'm absolutely buzzing. It was just electric and so entertaining.
And former Socceroos Scott McDonald is back with us on the Gegenpod as well. And Scott, we'll start with Portugal against Uruguay. What were your initial thoughts on this one as Portugal got a 2-0 win?
Yeah, look, I think Portugal, you know, particularly the start, were very, very good. One thing I'll have to ask Bridgie as well, would you have claimed that goal?
All day long, mate, I'm claiming that. That would have skimmed my... I would have just said it came off one of my little bristle pads here, mate. You know that.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, if you were looking for 9 World Cup goals, I'd certainly be claiming it as well. But look... Portugal got the job done in terms of what you have to say. Look, we look at Cavani and we look at Suarez. However, there's some real good talent within that Uruguayan squad. Valverde and obviously Nunes, who's at Liverpool. It's ever-changing for them, and it's probably that sort of middle-of-the-road time for them where they have to rebuild and go again for the next World Cup. A disappointing campaign for them, but Portugal, professional as ever, getting the job done. Now 2 wins from 2. And really looking good. Really looking good for the next phases of the tournament itself. So could we get that final that everyone is sort of wanting, the two best players in the world? Possibly. We'll see.
Bridgie, when we look at Uruguay, they are one of only 2 teams not to have scored in this tournament so far. The other one is Tunisia. For all the attacking firepower Uruguay have got, they still had 11 total shots. They actually had XG more or less the same as Portugal. Their open play XG was actually higher than Portugal. Is this a case of their attackers just not getting the job done, or is it the way the team plays, which is why they haven't found the back of the net yet?
It's the way the team sets up. It always is. They're such a good defensive unit. They never go and smash teams by a lot of goals. They're always hanging in there. And it wasn't till, you know, they were defensively so good and they were organised. Benton Kerr had an unbelievable chance when he went on a mazy run through the middle. And he should have scored, to be fair, the little dink over side. And, it, you know, he went try to go for the nutmegs and it hit the goalkeeper in the parts that we don't like to mention. But he saved the ball and it should have been a goal. So they've got themselves to blame in that regard, but with the firepower they've got, they don't play to that. And it wasn't until they went 1-0 down that all of a sudden they've got to come out and they've got to try and get a result. And they were creating chances after chances. Numbers were getting forward, and it was the, you know, they were really impacting Portugal's resolve at the back, and you leave yourself a little bit open. And obviously they copped a second goal from a penalty, which I don't think was a penalty, to be fair.
I thought
it was a shocking It's a shocking decision. Shocking.
Well, it hits his hand. It stops the momentum of the ball going to the other side. He's actually going to get to the other side of him.
Scotty, that's not deliberate, man. He's trying to make a challenge. I know he's got the nutmeg.
It's not deliberate, I'm not saying it's deliberate. Sorry about that bang, by the way. But
don't get so aggressive on the air, mate.
This is a slam the desk debate here.
Bridgie, if that's you, the attacker, say that's you, and you've knocked it past that defender and it's hit his hand, you're wanting that penalty all day long. Don't tell me you're not, because he's actually stopped you from having a goal-scoring opportunity.
Agree in that regard. I would be saying yes, but when I look, where do you put your hand as a defender? Where the hell do you put your hand in that instance? You're making a slide tackle, the ball, your hand's gone down behind. I disagree with it. Sorry, mate. If it was me, you know, and I was Bruno, I would have wanted it.
But you know what? It's an interesting one because there's so much grey area with the handball, and again, this is another argument within that. But I look at that from it has to be the advantage to the attacker. In all cases for me, there's a lot of times where it's not, where it hits the hand of the guy inside the box if you're an attacker, and it's definitely a handball, you know, and you don't get the goal if you've scored the goal. So it has to work on
Scotty. I've got the strikers union.
Yeah,
normally I'd go with you, but I disagree. No, I still don't think it was. And this is where you say, like, it's so open to interpretation, this handball rule. I don't understand it, so you don't understand it. The players don't understand it. So it'd be nice, you know, if somebody... What I wish would come out of this is that we could... I was sitting here, my wife was watching the game as well. She was like, I wish we could hear what the actual discussion is between the VAR and the referees and people in the stadium, people that are viewing the game. Mm. We get a sense of why that was given. I'm still baffled by it. But anyway, it wasn't to be. Portugal scored the goal, and like Uruguay, I just thought they were the too defensive minded when they've got that kind of talent up top. When I think they can go and win games,
I think it's the mentality of the Uruguayan way, though, Bridgie. They've always been that way. They've always been resolute, difficult to play against, physical. Sometimes a lot of gamesmanship within them. They like that character. That's their character. That's their DNA. And I think that's the way that they build upon, particularly in South American football. They aren't the glitz and the glamour of the Argentina or the Brazil itself. That's the way that they've grown up. And I think that's just the way as a nation that they like to play their football and what's expected of them from their nation as well. Yes, everyone wants to play pretty football. However, when they get to these competitions, they've had some real success in doing what they have done in previous tournaments. However, they just haven't took their chances, like we talked about. And that's, Theo, you talk about XG. Well, there you go. That just proves that needs to go in the bin for me. I'm not a fan of this XG stuff. I'm on one this morning, but... Like,
I'm with
XG,
you on that one, mate. I think it's absolute BS.
They didn't score. Why are we talking? I hear commentators call XG, XG, XG all the bloody time. Stop it. It doesn't mean anything. If the guy's 6 yards out and he can't plant one in there, then it doesn't matter about XG. It's all about the player in front of the goal. Stop it, please.
Scott McDonald's found an extra 20 years this morning, I reckon. So, guys, as we try to settle this debate about the penalty, I've sent you both a screenshot that's been circulating on Twitter. Funnily enough, Australian referees Sean Evans and Anton Shettinin were the assistant VARs for this. So we had two Australian referees in the VAR booth. We also had Ali Reza Fagani, who is an Australian-based referee. It was the central referee for this game. So we've got strong connections to Australia out of this very match. But I've sent you a graphic from the IFAB manual, which shows the IFAB's own definition of what is and isn't a handball, including that it's not an offence if the ball makes contact with a hand or arm that is supporting the body, which appears to be what was happening today. Now, with that said, I actually think it was a penalty. I don't necessarily think the rule is the greatest rule. But Bridgie, I suspect this means that you might be spot on here, because to the letter of the law, it looks like you're correct.
I'll tell you what, thank you so much for the clarity around that, mate, and to give me the bragging rights over Scotty Mac. He's still going to come back and have an argument. But I thought it was a dodgy decision, and it doesn't sit well knowing that there was a couple of Australians in charge of it neither. Oh, no, not another one.
Hey, mate, when have you ever played by the rules? Come on. Behave. Hey?
Never, but just look. I'm a bit of humble pie. Come on, just say, all right.
Look, the reality is always should be advantage to the attacker. It's like saying you have a shot, it's on target, it hits the hand, and he didn't mean it. But it's stopping a goal-scoring opportunity. I've always been a fan of if I have a strike and it hits someone on the arm and it's on its way on the target and he's made his body bigger by doing so, it should be a handball all day long. He's made his body bigger.
You're not listening. We've just discussed the rules of the game. It's just going to be like Souness and Roy Keane on Blooming on the Gegenpod here. Just listen. Listen to what I'm saying. It was a shocking decision.
That Uruguayan defender should have just stayed on his feet. That's all he should have done, Bridgie.
There you go. Then we wouldn't have had this argument.
We will leave that there for now, but a fantastic debate nonetheless, which I'm sure is being replicated in many languages around the world. Let's talk about Portugal. All the Portuguese media coming in were very worried that if they didn't win this group, they could get Brazil in the round of 16. All they need to do to guarantee that doesn't happen is they get a draw against South Korea in the final game and hope that Brazil get a draw and top their group by playing Cameroon in the final round. So how far can Portugal actually go? Scotty, have you been convinced by them? And now that they do avoid Brazil in the first knockout round, would you fancy their chances against Switzerland, Cameroon or Serbia in that next stage?
Look, I think they can go far. It's a bit like when they won the Euros. They're not very fancy. They're not amazing to watch. They're quite sticky in terms of how they play. They have got attacking intent. If you look at that team, that squad, particularly attacking-wise, you know, you've got João Felix, Rafael Leão coming off the bench, Ronaldo, obviously, Bruno Fernandes, and then you've got Cancelo, obviously, roaming down the wings as well. You know, Pepe's still playing somehow for I don't know what age he is now. It's unbelievable.
39.
Obviously, Ruben Dias is well, he's not that old then because I'm 39. So, but you know, like, and then you've got obviously Ruben Dias next to him. Look, I think they've got a wonderful team, a wonderful squad, and I do fancy them certainly in the round of 16 to get past that if they do finish top of the group.
Yeah, I think they've shown that they're hard to break down and they've got the firepower when regarded. I don't enjoy watching Portugal as I do other teams, but they know how to play tournament football and they know how to get results. And that test today was a huge test, and they managed it, and they managed it with a little bit of ease, I would say, to be honest with you, the way they did it. Like you say, being able to bring a 39-year-old on who didn't play the first game in Pepe, and they didn't test him at all. He looked so comfortable at the back. They didn't try and run him in behind many times. They controlled the game. So that shows that they're happy to make changes in a squad that is quality. So I think they'll do very, very well, yeah.
Well, as things stand, there could be Switzerland, and then there could be maybe Croatia or Germany. So their run will be very difficult, Portugal, if they are to go on a long run into this tournament. Let's check in Qatar with Mark Schwarzer now. And Schwarzy, how do Portugal compare to the tournament favourites like Brazil? And do they have the squad to go all the way?
I think if you want to compare Portugal and Brazil, there's some good comparisons. Up front, you're looking intact, Bruno Fernandes, Cristiano Ronaldo, João Felix. Certainly, all three of those players, there are question marks over their form coming into this World Cup. Domestically, for their own clubs, Ronaldo, we all know. João Felix has been on the outer at Atletico Madrid, and Bruno Fernandes certainly hasn't reached the levels that we've seen from him. Certainly, when he first arrived at the club, he was phenomenal. But they've still got a lot of attack. Bernardo Silva, Ruben Neves, phenomenal players as well. In defence, Pepe, Ruben Dias. Ruben Dias, I think, is a very, very good defender. João Cancelo, one of the best defenders, certainly wide players in the Premier League, and has been for the last at least season, if not season and a half. Pepe, obviously, is at the back end of his career, and he's 39 years old. The question mark will be about his retention of fitness, recovery, and is he able to still influence and be a top-class defender as he once was? Of course not. Age is against you. However, as long as he's still playing, as long as he's doing well, as long as he's not being found out, then why not? And I think if Portugal keep being successful, still getting the results, make it through to the knockout stages, it's very difficult to say otherwise. You know, if they win tonight against Uruguay, it's 2 from 2. And I think it's at the moment then job done. They're through the knockout stages and they start again come the knockout stages. Then we'll see when they come up against top opposition. This is then when it comes to the knockout stages, anything's possible. Portugal have the individual brilliance in their side to win games. Cristiano Ronaldo is the greatest example of that.
Thanks to Mark Schwarzer there, who's on the ground for us on the Gegenpod over in Qatar. Let's move on to the first game of the day. There'd been a lot of talk about how the early games hadn't produced many goals, especially in the first half. Well, the last time we got to see the very Australian-friendly 9 p.m. kickoff, it gave us one of the great games of the World Cup. Michael Bridges, Cameroon 3, Serbia 3, a real roller coaster of a game. How did that one leave you feeling?
This was magnificent. I was actually tucking into my cornflakes with milk this morning. It was 10 a.m. start here, and I was just absolutely loving it because The game itself, Serbia were absolutely magnificent to watch in the way they controlled and dominated the game. And then Cameroon just said, you know what it is? We're going to bring on Abubakar. Is that him? Abubakar?
Abubakar. Thank you. Yep.
That's the one. That's the guy. Mate, he was absolutely outstanding. And we talk about decisions that we don't like with VAR and the penalty discussion that we had. This guy looked a million miles offside for both goals. And yet the VAR came into play, the new system that they're using for the offside. And his movement was absolutely tremendous. And they got themselves back in the game and could have gone on to win it and totally just transformed again from a defensive unit team, threw caution to the wind, went forward. And the scenes, the celebrations, the scenes in the crowd were magnificent. And to see Mitrovic, you know, upset, they were absolutely fuming because they knew they let that game slip. So it's I think this group is I can't pick who's going to go through. Because the two teams have both got something completely different to offer. And I mean that with the defensive unit of Cameroon plus the counter-attack and the way Serbia just suffocated them and played some beautiful football.
Yeah, look, for me, Serbia will be absolutely kicking themselves, particularly you talked about Mitrovic there, Bridgie, at the end of the game, obviously upset. Rightly so, I think, you know, when you get as many glorious chances as what he had in that game, you know, he would have expected to have scored a lot more, particularly the form that he's found himself in the Premier League itself. But you've got to give Cameroon full credit. Obviously, the manager of Cameroon as well, making the change. Boubacar, you know, coming on and being electric and being the difference for them. Obviously, Choupo-Moting getting his goal as well, who's looked impressive at times, I think, for Cameroon. A little bit, probably, from what I've seen in terms of the two games, not really a team player, though. He's sort of played for individually, from what I've seen, looking to try and do what he can for himself, which is kind of interesting. There seems to be a little bit of, you know, arguments going on within the team itself. Every time you see a decision or he's doing something, that there's a couple of other players unhappy. So it's interesting to see what the balance in the camp would be there. Look, they've got a tough ask to play Brazil next. I can't really see them going through. But this, obviously, Serbia-Switzerland game is going to be a very interesting one to see who actually goes through in that one.
Does Serbia have any excuse for blowing that 3-1 lead, Scotty? Because they were in total control of the game and their high defensive line. Bridgie mentions how razor-thin those offside calls were. But I think just the stock camera angle, Bridgie, was a bit misleading because when they had the exact side on camera, even the third goal, the Cameroonian attacker was just a mile onside. It was just a brilliant run in the end. But maybe it seemed a little bit deceiving on first watch. But what excuse, if any, does Serbia have for blowing such a good advantage in this game?
They have none whatsoever. You know, I just talked about there in terms of they could have killed that game off. You would have thought they had of it 3-1 as well. But they could have been well and truly home and host early on in the game as well. Did well to come back from 1-0 down, and you would fully expect them to hold out. However, you know, that high line came at a costly price in the end for them, and you know, gave up 2 points in the end, I believe.
I think it was a bit of naivety as well. When you're controlling a game like they were, and you know that Cameroon are bringing on some fast players where you're vulnerable in behind, there's no need to play that high line when you're 3-1 up. You can actually drop off and give yourself a load of the breathing space, and that's why I talk about when you see Portugal going up and they control the game, they're happy to go on the attack, and if they can't get down one of their flanks, they'll quite happily go back to the fullback, go back to the centre half, go back to the goalkeeper, and just absolutely kill the game off and play that possession based where they and you know, Serbia were in complete control, and I really thought they were just trying to showboat and get a fourth and get a fifth and get a sixth when they didn't need to, because the game was done and dusted for them.
Now, there was real drama before kickoff in this game with Andre Onana left out of the Cameroon squad. An official statement saying that after a discussion with the head coach, he had insisted on a different style of goalkeeping. And Fabrizio Romano reported that Rigobert Song wanted a more traditional style of goalkeeping. Certainly when Cameroon were 3-1 down, it was looking like they missed Andre Onana quite a lot. But Scotty, you've coached, you no doubt have had players push back and you've had to lay down your authority. Did Rigobert Song do the right thing here based on what's come out in the press?
Probably yes. You know, in terms of, you know, he's a coach at the end of the day, he makes the decisions. He's inside the camp, he'll know more than us. So for me, as a manager's union now, I look upon it in terms of you have to make those tough choices.
for the group and for yourself in terms of getting the results. And look, I think it probably was, albeit they missed him. But for me, it's you live by the sword, you die by the sword as a manager. And he's certainly living by that at the moment in terms of the criticism that he may or may not have got for it as well.
Yeah, again, but we're not in the inner camp. We haven't seen what has gone on, Scotty, but as coaches, and you know, you're still managing, there's nothing worse than being undermined when you're getting questioned by your philosophy. You've got a team at the World Cup, so he's got every right. If that is how it's unfolding, there's been a heated discussion in front of the players, and he's undermined the manager. The right decision has been made. You cannot do that. He hasn't got his pro diploma badge. He hasn't got his coaching, and if it was done in the wrong manner, then he's got every right. Maybe it could have been handled better inside, but we're just hearing the what had gone on. If it is interpreted like that, I think the right decision was made, definitely.
Now, before we throw to Mark Schwarzer for his thoughts on this topic, I wanted to put to both of you the various strengths of the confederations in this tournament. We've seen individual results like Japan beating Germany and Saudi Arabia beating Argentina, and then on behalf of CAF, the African Federation, Morocco beating Belgium, and then we'll get to Ghana beating South Korea. Is there a decline in South America, though? I mean, Argentina and Brazil came in as the clear top two favourites. Ecuador are holding their own and may well still go through, but they've got to take care of Senegal in order to do that. And, of course, one of the reasons that South America has one team fewer at this World Cup is because Australia beat Peru in the knockouts to get there. So, Bridgie, is South America on a whole in decline, or does the performance of Argentina and Brazil drag them up to still maintain their status as perhaps second strongest confederation behind Europe?
I don't think they're on a decline. I think the rest of the world or the other confederations have all upped their game and found different ways to compete and play against the South American teams. Argentina have started slowly, no doubt about it, but they came into the back of this off 36 unbeaten, winning the Copa America. Like you can't say that they've been underestimated. Brazil, slow start, but what have they done? They've won both their games. They've found a way, and that is them not even ticking yet. So they are strong contenders. However, like the other contingent, you know, Uruguay, and you've mentioned Ecuador. You don't know what you're going to get from Ecuador. Uruguay, me and Scott, you've said, very, very defensive. Teams have found a way. So I think I wouldn't say that they are still the elitist or the ones to be feared, because there are so many other factors and teams now that we're seeing at the World Cup that can cause upsets. And why is that? Well, they've found a way to play. They've got different styles. Changing for the Japan game against Germany, I thought that it was a tactical stroke of genius. They went from a back four, they went to a back three and played wing backs, and Germany couldn't handle it. So I think the coaching, the understanding, the team dynamics from other regions and confederations have gone through the roof.
All right, well, let's get Mark Schwartz's thoughts on this and go over to Schwartzy in Qatar.
Yeah, absolutely. I think South America is as intimidating, if not even more intimidating, as they have been before. Look, Argentina coming into this World Cup were 35 games on the bounce without losing a game. Yes, they lost their opening game, and it was a massive shock to lose to Saudi Arabia. Probably the biggest shock at a World Cup ever, and that's a massive statement. When you look at Brazil, Brazil have been almost in cruise control. Uruguay, of course, they're a side that have a rich history in the World Cup and obviously haven't performed thus far to any expectation during their first game, and currently finding it difficult against Portugal. So I think Ecuador, another group, you know, I think they'll probably go through in Group A, and deservedly so. I think South America is still as big, as intimidating as they have ever been before. And of course, as always, led by Brazil. And at the moment, a little bit behind Argentina, but that could change very, very quickly.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Gegen Pod. We've got former Socceroos Scott McDonald and former Premier League star Michael Bridges. We've still got a couple of games to look at from the World Cup overnight. Brazil, they were thrilling in their opening game against Serbia, and they were the dominant side and got the job done 1-0 against Switzerland here. Scott, they didn't quite set the match on fire the way they did against Serbia, and Vinicius Junior's disallowed goal was pretty exciting, never mind the actual winner from Casemiro. What did you make of Brazil's performance as they go 2-from-2 and guarantee that they will be in the knockout stages?
Look, job done. They're still, for me, it's almost like watching the older Brazil. You know, they're still exciting to watch. Technically, they're brilliant. The way they move the ball, they controlled that game from start to finish. You know, Switzerland never had a shot on target the whole game. So defensively, they're looking quite solid as well. Yes, they do miss Neymar, there's no question, because when he plays, we know that the extra attention that he gets, and what that does is obviously brings players towards him, which creates spaces for others. But what about the goal as well? Casemiro's strike. My God. You know, Brazil are doing Brazilian things at this tournament. You know, if you look at Richarlison's goal and you look at Casemiro's goal, the technical ability that they show, it's wonderful to see. It's wonderful to see Brazil doing that again, because for the last couple of World Cup campaigns, you'd have to say that they haven't looked them normal selves. They've gone to a different style of play, a little bit more pragmatic. And you'd have to say Tite's, you know, tactics at the start of the game was a little bit pragmatic in terms of the team that he picked. But if you look at the changes that he made, I think that was the biggest difference. You know, bringing in Guimarães, Antony and Gabriel Jesus, I think that's when the game changed a little bit and opened up a little bit more. And it's nice to have those options on the bench, isn't it? So, you know, man for man, they're, you know, across 26 players, they're looking very strong.
I have to say, the first 45 minutes of the game, there was only one game that was more boring than this game, and that was England against the USA. Because England was just Harry Maguire passing to to Stones, and then Stones passing back to Maguire. This first half, it didn't excite us in the way that I was expecting Brazil to, and you've got to credit Switzerland for that. They tried to stop them, they nullified them, they got them out of the rhythm. But like you say, Scotty, they find a way, and that is the scary part. They've got so many X-factor players that can win them games. You saw Richarlison, Casemiro's done it this time. Vinicius Junior is just, he can beat anybody from a standing start. So I think that looking at it, how slowly and they've stuttered, but they've got the maximum points, I'm worried. I had these to be the champions from the start of the competition. I think they're just going to gather momentum because they haven't been firing, but they've got 6 points.
Well, Scott, you mentioned pragmatism and Brazil, you know, looking a bit more like the Brazil of old, but their defence is underrated. Alisson hasn't had to make a save yet, and it's the first time that a team hasn't faced a shot on target in the first two games since France in 1998, and they went on to win it. So as much as we associate Brazil with Jogo Bonito and entertaining football, is the reality here that they're just the best defensive team at the tournament as well?
Well, you know what they say, Theo, don't they? The best form of defence is attack. And I think that's the way they play on the front foot, and they control the game. They control the ball. So if you can control the ball, then the opposition can't score goals, can they? And I think that's what they're very good at, keeping the ball. And obviously they have that fear factor as well, that teams are just dropping right off them. Switzerland looked at the first game against Serbia, and like Bridgie said there, defensively they were very, very solid for a good period of time within the game, very disciplined. Shaqiri obviously didn't start that game as well for Switzerland, which told you the intent of the Swiss team right from the off. But look, they've just got a little bit more X factor within their, like Bridgie said there, in their team now as well, but from an attacking perspective. The reliance isn't just solely on Neymar anymore. If you look back to 2014 World Cup, then obviously that's all they had. But you've got Jesus, you've got, you know, Antony, Richarlison, Rafinha now.
Martinelli.
There's just so many different options for them. Yeah, Martinelli as well. Geez, oh, so.
Do you know the other thing that, you know, the other thing that I think they're absolutely magic at, and so are Manchester City and Pep Guardiola? Every time the opposition get the ball and they're trying to attack, what they're doing on the halfway line, they just absolutely do the best little technical fouls I've ever seen. And then what does that do? That breaks the play up. What do? You get numbers back behind the ball, and then you've got to beat the 10 players again. They are absolute geniuses. I was just watching the game tonight. The amount of fouls that they made against the Switzerland attackers when they were trying to counter was phenomenal. And it's a very, very clever gamesmanship that they do. And Pep and Manchester City do it so well, and yet they never seem to get yellow cards.
Well, let's get Mark Schwartz's thoughts now on the Brazil team, starting with the balance between the attackers and how defensive the side is. Schwartz, expand on that for us.
Yeah, of course, when you compare Brazil to, say, the Brazils in 2002 and the superstars of Brazil years gone by, I mean, the only real standout absolute superstar is Neymar. And we find him obviously injured and potentially missing two games of the group. Up front, Richarlison, Rafinha, Vinicius Jr., are they household names? Vinicius Jr., of course, playing for Real Madrid. Rafinha now at Barcelona. They're getting there, but I don't think they're classed as absolute superstars just quite yet. I mean, Vinicius Jr. is probably a good argument to say he is up there. In defence, though, they've got those robust stalwarts, Thiago Silva, Marquinhos, two no-nonsense defenders who have got an enormous amount of experience, but also skillful enough to play in a Brazil side and have done for many, many years. And I think Brazil at the moment seem to have a really nice mix, able to keep clean sheets, score goals, and it's two from two for them. So certainly beware, because Brazil, even though they're not the big name Brazil as we're used to with all these massive superstars, they've still got some massive name. Casemiro midfield is a phenomenal player. And I think, you know, when you've got a player like him in your midfield, anything is possible. Richarlison scoring goals for Brazil, even though he didn't score today, but he is more than capable, showed in the first game how good he can be. So beware.
Mark Schwartzer there. All right, let's move on to the final game of the morning. Arguably the best of the games. Gee, we had some good ones overnight. South Korea 2, Ghana 3. Ghana 2-0 up. South Korea come back. Crowd was fantastic for this as well. Just amazing celebrations on all five of the goals, really. And Bridgie, the man who put himself up in lights was 22-year-old Mohamed Kudus. Scored at the second and third goals, the winning goal for Ghana in this game. What a moment for him on the world stage.
Yes, if there's anywhere you want to shine, it's at a World Cup. And what's he done? Like you said, he's playing for Ajax. He's also played for Ajax second team. He's scored goals. He plays, he's an attacking midfielder, but he can play up top as well. So he's versatile. And what I really admired today is the way he managed to get himself. As strikers, me and Scotty, We'll tell you, you've got to try and get in between either two centre-halves, or you've got to try and get in between the centre-half and the full-back. And his anticipation for the crosses, the way that he managed to get himself in between, and the quality of the header was great. But then the anticipation and the way he positioned himself for the second goal to get Ghana that 3-2 win, you can just tell he oozes class, and at such a young age, he's shining at the World Cup for this team. And I'm delighted, because I thought the crowd, like you've mentioned there, Theo, was spectacular. There was when the fans of the Ghanaian celebrated, almost like you saw everybody having a heart attack. It was amazing, and they're so flamboyant. The colours are beautiful, and I just thought it was a very, very fitting way for them to win that game.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, kudos to Kudus.
God.
I had to get that one in. But, first Ghanaian to score a double at a World Cup. Could he be the next Asamoah Gyan, who obviously lit up, the World Cup in, I think it was it 2010 South Africa,
He scored in 6 and 10, so he had two pretty good tournaments. And he scored in 14 as well. He scored in three tournaments in a row.
Yeah, he did. But this boy looks the business, doesn't he? And I love it when we see, from our perspective, the unknowns hit the highs of the World Cup and really set the stage alight and become, top players that we look upon going ahead. And he could certainly be one. And I love Ghana as well, because they've come into the tournament, and a lot of people said that probably they're the weakest African side to be in the World Cup itself, for a lot of pundits. But look, they've given themselves a great opportunity now to get through to the last 16. And look, I always like the African story as well, and you always want them to do well, because we want to see them have success at a World Cup. They've still failed to do that. Ghana's probably reached the first. Cameroon had a great one in 1990, wasn't it, as well. So, it'd be a great story if they were to go a little bit further. And look, Morocco are doing well as well, but I think Ghana are probably a big threat that you wouldn't want to play them, because they're so unpredictable.
The only thing I thought was disrespectful was the way after the game, Ghana, there was one of the coaching staff went to console Son and just kind of put his arm around him. But he actually had his selfie stick in his camera there, trying to get a selfie while Son was being humiliated. I thought it was absolutely bang out of order, but very, very funny.
Now, just on Kudus, he's getting attention from some of Europe's top clubs, including Liverpool, who he scored against in the Champions League. He also scored in both games against Rangers, and he scored the one when Napoli beat Ajax 6-1. So he's got 4 in 6 there. He's got 5 in the Dutch League. But, Scotty, I wanted to ask you about his pathway, because he was in the Right to Dream Academy in Ghana for 6 years, from 2012 to 2018. Then he went to Nordsjælland, and after a couple of seasons at Nordsjælland in Denmark, he's gone to Ajax, and now he's going to make that leap seemingly off the back of this World Cup and a huge price tag. Ajax are going to make themselves a nice little transfer fee, as you can imagine. But interesting there, he was from age 12, he was in the Right to Dream Academy in Ghana. And I know that this World Cup in Qatar, there's been so much said about the Aspire Academy, and I guess how talent from third world or developing nations gets found and gets nurtured and then finds their way to Europe. I mean, it's not a unique story, but it is fascinating when we see players come through this sort of a pathway. And then now there's a bit more of a linear progression, Danish League, Dutch League, and maybe, hey, Premier League.
Yeah, are we sort of walking along the lines again of suggesting that we should have something similar over here in Australia? I think we are. And if you are, then I fully agree with you. But someone needs to put their hand in their pockets. The sports minister's been there. Why doesn't she help us out? You know, they keep saying they're helping us. So is James Johnson at the moment. But look, we need something more there for our young talents to come through. The A-Leagues at the moment isn't doing enough for me in terms of the academy development. So is it something we can do? I think so. However, the pathway for, obviously, Kudos is a wonderful one. And it shows you that, obviously, you've got to keep believing and you've got to keep driving. And look, the way that the Africans have to go through the system, they have to go far and wide to actually achieve where they need to get to. It's very similar to our pathway because they haven't got the passport. So you have to go to these unfancied countries like Norway, Denmark, or of the likes before you can actually get to those
Scotland,
big leagues.
Sorry,
and he's done that.
That's where Scotland, they're all going.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to do that first and prove yourself. And he's certainly done that.
Can I just put it out there? I don't think Kudos would have had to pay $2,000 to $3,000 every year for him to be in that academy as well, because I think he would have slipped through the net, to be honest with you. So that's still another massive issue that I've taken away from being in Australia, with having my daughter at academies at the Newcastle Jets and the regio fees for all these kids. I know Swartzy did a fantastic piece and proposed the question across. Hopefully we do get some answers in the future, because I still think that's a massive flaw in the Australian development, because there's so many kids out there that parents can't afford to support that pathway.
Bridgie, one question for you. What are you paying for your daughter now in terms of the football club that she's now signed for over there?
Oh, minimal. She gets what would it be? Maybe, what, £100? And should that include your strip and everything?
There you go. Okay, that's all I wanted to ask, because I knew the answer.
Just to finish on Kudus, looking at the graduates or the notable alumni from the Right to Dream Academy, most of the players are playing in, you know, Czech Republic, Scandinavia, Switzerland, many of them in second or lower divisions. Mohamed Kudus's transfer fee, if he does leave Ajax for Liverpool, is going to be more than every other player to come through that academy combined as well. So, Bridgie, a phenomenal piece of business. Based on what you've seen, is he ready for the Premier League at 22, even in January, or is he more of an off-season transfer given the price tag that might be attached?
If it's, I can't give him advice, but if it was my advice to be saying, I think you're looking at the end of the season, finish off what you're doing at Ajax, get the whole season under your way. Your last thing you want to do is join a team halfway through the season in Liverpool. Are you going to get game time? Or you just, you know, it's going to be great to be part of that setup or with a Premier League club. But nah, get the full season out of the way. Get yourself some time to settle down and do. It doesn't want to be a rush transfer neither. You've got, you know, it's going to be a crazy period after the World Cup, getting back to normality in the game. Then the January window is just absolutely manic. It would be a fantastic move in the summer. So you can decide where you're going to go. You can do it strategically, right? And as long as you've got the best advice and representation, I mean, if you want to take something like that, Erling Haaland was looked after by his father, Alfie, who I played with. They chose Dortmund because of the style of play that Dortmund would fit Alfie, and look what's happened to him. He's gone to another team. So that instead of jumping at something, if you can get the right advice, that's something that's going to suit your game. It can obviously set you up for the rest of your life for your playing style and your financial situation.
All right, let's move on to some predictions for the final group games. Unfortunately for us in Australia, we lose both the 9 p.m. and the midnight now, so it's back to night owls. It'll be a good warm-up for Premier League returning, I suppose. Are we all assuming that the Netherlands take care of business against Qatar, turning Ecuador versus Senegal into a straight knockout where Ecuador goes through with a draw, Senegal would have to win? Bridgie, what's going to happen in Group A?
I feel for Qatar. This could be a complete humiliation. The Dutch have looked absolutely, you know, they've controlled most of their games possession-wise. They've scored goals. I feel for Qatar. This could be absolutely horrendous. And then the other one, I'm just really looking forward to seeing what happens. It's either team are enjoyable to watch. I can't call it, but I'm going to be glued to it. But I can tell you, Qatar will get stuffed.
I'm in agreement with you, Bridgie. I think Netherlands will fully control this game. Depends on, obviously, the changes that they make, but there'll be some hungry players playing for that Netherlands squad, trying to, obviously, get a start in the next phase. And I think Ecuador will get the job done as well against Senegal. I just think they might just have enough to get over the line, and that will be the two that qualify for the next phase.
Well, the Dutch have every incentive to go for it because, of course, if Ecuador win, then it'll come down to goal difference for who tops the group. And now let's look at Group B. Wales against England, Iran versus the USA. Wales just about out, but England, they start the day top. Iran start the day second. If they beat the USA, they're through. Of course, if England get a draw against Wales, they will go through. But they'll want to top the group. So, Bridgie, how do you see Group B shaking out? Which two teams go through and who tops the group?
Well, just like I said about Qatar, I really feel for Wales. They're going to get absolutely smashed. So England will be England will be going through on top. Gareth Bale and the boys will be packing their bags and going home. And do you know what it is? I would like to see the USA do it because Tyler Adams and Aronson are both part of Leeds United. And I thought the way that they give it to England and showed them up and showed that they were, you know, they're a young, fit team that know how to press and win the ball back. I think they'll have too much for Iran. So I'll say England top, followed by USA second, Iran, and the Welsh will be going home rock bottom, unfortunately.
Look, Bridgie, I know we've disagreed a lot this morning, but I'm in agreement with you on this one as well. Look, I think England will have way too much for Wales. Wales, for me, have looked poor throughout this tournament, and I think the way that England will move the ball, they'll just have too much for them. And this could be a decent scoreline for England as well. Not to the same of what Iran was, but you know, it'd be a convincing victory, I think. Anyhow, even though it's a, you know, battle of Britain a little bit, and these games can get, you know, quite sticky at times, I still think England, just with the quality that they have, they'll have too much. The other one, obviously, that the Iran American game. Obviously, this is a big game, not just on the pitch but off the pitch, for reasons gone by. Iran actually have beaten USA at a World Cup before. As we know, I think that was in France, was it? France 98, I believe they beat them, if I go off the record books. So, tough game for the USA, this one. Can they get it done? I think they will, Bridgie. And I've been very impressed by them as well, particularly in that England game. And they come out with that energy and high press, Iran. I think you know, they'll get the job done on the night as well. And they've got some young talent there that have really, really impressed me. That Musiala, is it Musa, sorry? In the midfield for America, he's been excellent.
Musa. And they've got Weah's son.
Yeah,
Weah's son, mate. Anybody that's got George Weah's son in the team, I'm gunning for them.
Well, he was at Celtic as well. Previously, he was on loan from PSG, so I know a bit about him. He's an excellent talent, and now he's proving to be that. I think he's obviously in the French league, still doing very well. But yeah, he's been very impressive in this World Cup as well.
Yeah, so big thanks to Michael Bridges and Scott McDonald and also Mark Schwarzer over in Qatar as well. Don't forget, the Gegenpod is daily during the World Cup, so make sure to hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate us 5 stars while you're there. If the World Cup isn't enough of a football fix, you can still catch the WSL, which is being played through the World Cup, live games and also highlights exclusive on Optus Sport. My name's Teo Pelizzeri, and I'll be back with you tomorrow, so make sure you have hit subscribe to catch the daily drops. Thanks for listening to the Optus Sport Football Podcast. This was the Gegenpod.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.